Welcome to the devotional. This is the first session this morning, and I'm Mark Thomas. I'm happy to be here with you in this early morning for a topic that I think is timely and exciting and enough to wake you up in the morning. Feedback. What's that? Feedback. Yes. Okay. First of all,
how's that?
Is that better? Let me move back farther. Maybe that will help. Okay. This session is being sponsored, this devotional is being sponsored by Utah Interfaith Power and Light. There are bookmarks up here up at the front. You can see a logo with a, what are those lights called? The
compact fluorescent.
Compact fluorescent lights. They're kind of a beehive and... you may want to come up and take one of those if you're interested. Today we're going to be listening to Steve Ritchie read selections from sermons on the stewardship of the earth. Utah Power and Light has sponsored a contest for composers of music and for faith messages or sermons, sacrament meeting speeches, and so forth. We will hear just a few selections from those. That contest is now in progress and will soon end. One other thing, Utah Interfaith Power and Light, just to give you an idea, is a nonprofit organization interested in saving energy and helping fight climate change, particularly in faith communities. Today, Steve Ritchie is from the board of Utah Interfaith Power and Light, and he has a diverse background in many fields. He has been an American Baptist, Presbyterian, and is now a member of the United Church of Christ. He received his Bachelor of Science degree in biology with emphasis in biochemistry, ecology, and physiology. After 10 years of radiation and cancer research and information chemistry, Steve now works as a consultant in information systems and software design. And he's a member of the board for Utah Interfaith Power and Light. So, Steve, we'll turn the time over to you. Thank you for being here.
Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to move down here a little bit closer to you all, a little bit less formal as we enter this devotional period. As Mark said, the Utah Chapter of Interfaith Power and Light, which is a national organization of some 4,000 congregations, we had the opportunity to have an award program for sermons, and sermons including tafsirs, which is what it would be if we were Muslim, sacrament speeches, and homilies and anything very similar, and even addresses to church school classes and so forth. But what we did was we posted this on the web and got the word out through the media back around Earth Day, just to try and let people know that we were interested in messages to people of faith on the subject of climate change and sustainability of the Earth. And that's a major focus point for Interfaith Power and Light. It's an organization that started about 10 years ago by an Episcopal priest, Sally Bingham, who actually came to Utah when we were starting out. She's appeared on CNN and various other organizations or media, just getting the word out, and that's what we're striving to do, where people of faith identify a connection with God's creation. And so we're so glad that you all could be here this morning. And I've got several sermons here. We've received a good number of them. Interestingly enough, we've also received music compositions because many other states, a number of other states, had sermon award programs also. But we're the only state that had a music program. And tomorrow at 11:15, you'll have an opportunity, as we have a panel discussion, to hear one of the music selections that we've received. So the first sermon comes to us from George Hanley. Many of you know George Hanley, a faculty at BYU. Well, he's a person who's made a great stand in terms of God's creation and in terms of the Mormon connection to it, and we've interacted with him numerous times. In fact, we have a Spanish-speaking page on our website, which George wrote, and we're very grateful for that. But George submitted this sermon, and it's called Heaven and Earth, Thinking Through Environmentalism. And it's appropriate that I'm down here on the floor because George sees this less, as he told me, less as a sermon and more as a fireside chat. So it's good that we're down here. I also will mention that we are doing excerpts, but there's a lot of continuity to each of the sermons so that you're not getting bits and pieces here and there, but in most cases we're starting a little ways through and not going all the way to the end so that you won't hear, three or four in their entirety, so you don't have to worry about that. At any rate, George writes and has spoken. Unfortunately, so much of our modern technology-enhanced life has divorced us of a kinship with nature. Whether because of the virtual reality of television and the internet, our controlled climates, or because we no longer produce our own food. Because of our alienation from nature begins so early, our exposure to it begins to fill us with kind of a nostalgia for something more, as if we were seeking something lost. And what specifically is that we have lost? A purely ecological view of human existence would suggest that what we long for, what we recall in those moments of disappearing self, in an understanding of our merely embodied biological identity as physical beings, who too easily succumb to the illusion of our separateness from the physical world. We must not be deceived. In other words, what appears to be our distinct and exceptional capacity for conscious thought, because of our true and only home, is the earth. A view of human existence that insists on our merely spiritual identity would argue that we long for a sense of belonging to God, that nature only helps us to begin to imitate. We should not be deceived, in other words, by the appearance of things and by our essential experience of our kinship with them, because of our true and only home is heaven. Joseph Smith's vision suggests the possibility that we have lost both, and that this is simply a false dichotomy. His vision and subsequent revelations contained in the Doctrine and the Covenants and the Pearl of the Great Price consistently teach that we are both embodied and inspirited, biological and spiritual, and that these are not temporary contradictions that will be resolved in death, separation of the spirit and the body, and of heaven and earth. Spirit is matter, the prophet explained. And all physical life was created spiritually before it was physically on earth. All things, therefore, hide beneath their tangible surface a spiritual entity that inhabits the same space. He taught, the elements that are eternal, and spirit, an element, or physical matter, inseparably connected, receive a fullness of joy. And when separated, man cannot receive a fullness of joy. And that's from the Doctrines and Covenant 93, verses 33 through 34. Cannot receive a fullness of joy. Our happiness is limited if our physical experience is not enhanced by the spirit, and if our spiritual experience is not enhanced by physical life. The prophet's revelations make it clear that our eternal life will be an embodied one, like God's, and that the earth will become the site of the highest level of exaltation. Nature, then, provides a profoundly unique and valuable opportunity to understand the delicate balance between the spirit and the body, heaven and earth. So it was that I attended my Sunday school classes, and despite my adolescent resistance to throw myself wholly into my religion, I remember the doctrines that first grabbed my attention. I instinctively recognized the truth that animals and trees were living souls, and thus my kin. And that's from Moses 3:9. I hadn't always heard the voice of the Lord in my meetings, but I had spent enough time under the stars and floating in the sea. There we go. Let's move that cord like that. There we go. We've got it. All right. I hadn't always heard the voice of the Lord in my meetings, but I'd spent enough time under the stars and floating in the sea to implicitly entrust, to trust the idea that all things denote there is a God. That's Alma 30:44. And that all things created and made to bear record of Christ, Moses 6:63. My young mind was being prepared to understand just how confused all things were by the light of Christ. As the prophet revealed in the section 88:7-12 of the Doctrine and the Covenants, when I contemplate these words now, quote, as also he is in the sun, he is also in the moon. I can see my teenage self surrounded by his light, even in the midst of my adolescent angel, my body glistening in the sun after dipping in the sea or bathed in moonlight on my lawn at night, but I often sat to ponder the life's purpose. Although I thought I sought nature so I could be alone to sort out my choices away from human missives of family and church and friends, or a jetty overlooking the sound one night at the age of 17, when I finally came to realize that I was never alone, that I was surrounded by his love and light, that I could not repent and follow him, and that it would be my choice. I did not appreciate the fully the broad and global implications of these doctrines until I became aware of the extent of our contemporary environmental crisis. In college at Stanford University, and then graduate school at UC Berkeley, and then into my early 30s as a professor in Northern Arizona University, I learned about the frightening and increasing rates of species extinction worldwide. I remember hearing the early debates about global warming and having noticed the growth of what is now remarkable consensus among scientists about its reality. Of course, there were disappearing rainforests, deforestation, soil erosion in poor countries, the millions who live without safe drinking water, the disasters of pollution. But closer to home, I read about the disappearing water tables in the American West, even as I was part of the increasing growth. And I watched our dependence on oil implicate us repeatedly in conflicts in the Middle East and threw us into war. Throughout my education, I had always had respect for the environment and an instinctive belief in the need for restraint and conservation. But I wasn't able to formulate a way for me to act. As I reflect upon this now, I can find at least three reasons this was the case. I could not overcome my own inertia to change my life. The problems often seemed too complex to know exactly how to act. And in my undergraduate experience at Stanford, it seemed that environmental issues were always discussed in the context of population control. You weren't a true environmentalist unless you committed to having no more than two children. It didn't help that the general culture of environmentalism, as far as I could see, while studying in California, didn't seem friendly to Christians. Christians of all stripes and easy targets for our belief in the millennial reign of Christ, our reluctance to unduly limit the size of our families, and our trust in divine providence. At Northern University, Arizona University, however, I made friends with a small group of scholars who were intensely interested in broad questions of how we can define and use our quality of life, economic choices, and beliefs so as to benefit more effectively the well-being of the physical world now and in the future. I took the opportunity to attend a workshop aimed at helping professors in all fields see the relevance of their field of study to questions of sustainability, Sustainability was defined in terms of principles, not policies, and they included the notion that individual choices could be valued for their effect when we imagine that they are made by an entire society over several generations. If one gum wrapper is left by a lakeside, it may not be measurable. But if we all individually assume that we only need to measure the individual effect of our puny acts, then we are justified in throwing wrappers on the ground. A collective group acting with such impunity wouldn't take more than a few weeks to make an enormous mess. And if thousands do so on a weekly basis for generations, worse still. As I heard these discussions, I couldn't help thinking that I had heard them before in LDS teachings about the law of consecration, the spirit of Elijah that inspires us to consider the effects of our actions on future generations and to measure them against the example set by our ancestors. And Christ's teaching about moderation, it represents such a high standard that I also reflected on the need for patience and tolerance, since it didn't seem likely that anyone could live in such a way that nothing they did would cease harm if replicated worldwide. As Jesus had taught, he is who without sin. One day, while walking with a colleague, a Jewish scholar who studied Judaism's environmental values, I spoke of LDS beliefs about the spiritual creation that came before the physical one, the fate of the earth as the site of the celestial kingdom, the world of wisdom and its emphasis on eating meat sparingly, and a variety of other doctrines that seemed relevant to the environmental problems. She insisted that I research this further and publish something. She was sure people outside Mormonism were not aware of these unusual doctrines, and that perhaps Mormons themselves would benefit from contemplating further what our scriptures teach about environmental stewardships. Thus began a wonderful journey of discovery. It seemed that everything I had learned and had come to believe shone in a new light of understanding. As I read deeply in the literature about religion and about the environment and about the environmental problems generally, and as I continued my personal study of the gospel, it was hard not to feel excited about the answers that it seemed the restored gospel provided. I learned that some scholars argue that the Judeo-Christian tradition bore responsibility for the environmental crisis. Specifically, these scholars saw the biblical injunction to assume dominion over the earth as a license to act without regard for the well-being of God's creations. They likewise pointed to Christianity's outright rejection of animism, the idea that all living things had spirits, and enabled this immoral view of our own nature, because arguably we're not likely to feel an ethical sense of responsibility towards something we view as dead matter. Furthermore, they insisted Christianity's tendency to value the spirit over the body and heaven over earth had led to an attitude of indifference toward the world's degradation. If the earth is going to be destroyed anyway, and we will then eventually depart it, why bother protecting it? While the logic of these arguments perfect sense to me, and I had no many doubt that many Christians were guilty as charged, I simply did not believe in that version of Christianity because I had studied our doctrines. I knew this was not simply due to my own idiosyncratic way of seeing things. Christianity was also used to uphold slavery, but it was also a chief inspiration of the abolitionists. Besides, it isn't pragmatic to suggest a worldwide view held by millions should simply be discarded. Seeking common ground is more effective since the environmental programs are global and require global solutions. In my mind, this necessitates working together across distinct values and traditions with tolerance. This one, this sermon comes to us from Hottie United Church of Christ, Reverend Aaron Gilmore. And it's called A Prayer from the Earth, and it's based on Psalm 8 and Luke 12. In 1992, Bill McKibben, a prolific writer and environmentalist activist, went out and found the largest cable station in the whole world, which at that time was in Fairfax, Virginia, and had 100 channels. He had different people in Fairfax tape all 100 channels during a 24-hour time period, and then went home to the tapes and watched roughly 2,000 hours of programming. Distilled down to the essence of what he heard in the message was this: you're the most important thing on Earth. You're the center of the planet. It's a message we've been listening to a long, long, long time, far too long. The results of this message are all around us: melting ice caps, mass extinctions, dying forests, rising oceans. We have forgotten who we are. We have forgotten that we stand in relation to everything else. We have accepted comfort and excess in exchange for balance and responsibility. When I think about what we've become, I often think of seagulls in Finding Nemo, where they just say over and over, "Mine, mine, 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 mine." Our culture has become so accustomed to having that it defines itself by stuff and by possessions, according to all those messages that make us out to be the most important thing on the planet. It is our cars, our choice of beer, our vacation homes that are going to make us happy. This is the essence, the message says, of what it means to be human: to have, to acquire, to own. If we go back to the Hebrew language, we hear a different message. The word for man is Adam, and the word for earth is Adamah. They have the same root. They bear and the intimate connection between humanity and the earth. We are more likely to hear truth about who we are from an ancient language than we are when we turn on the television. We are not from the center of the earth. We are of the earth. And we are a part of the earth. It would be easy to take scripture like Psalm 8 that reads, "What are human beings that you are mindful of them, mortals that you care for them? Yet you have made them a little lower than God and crowned them with glory and honor. You've given them dominion over the works of your hands. You've put all things under their feet, all sheep and oxen, and also the beasts of the field, and the birds of the air, and the fish of the sea. Whatever passes along the path of the seas." And use this as justification and proof that God has put humans above all other creatures. But when it is distilled down to the essence, the writer of Psalm 8 is baffled that God would entrust God's most amazing creation to the likes of us. What are we that you would count on us to take care of the creatures of the earth? Is it an awesome responsibility that you have the power to destroy, to create, to progress, to choose? For the past few hundred years, the industrialized nations of this world have chosen to abuse that power. We've believed ourselves to be more important and thereby more valuable than any other species on the planet. This, Bill McKibben says, is a crime against the rest of creation, against all the other interesting corners of God's brain. We need to hear and share a different message, not just an adoration to care for the earth, but a call to relationship with the earth. Perhaps the most important contributions we can make in a community of faith is in the effort to combat global warming, is around this question of identity. We are one of the only institutions left in society that still conceives of something other than accumulation, as a reason for existence on this planet. Now, what if everyone in the congregation would gather up their trash during the week and bring it to church on Sunday. And then during the offering, everyone could bring up their bags of trash and their bag or bags as an offering to the earth. It would be offensive in this place, in this sacred place. Yet isn't that what we say about the earth? The land is sacred. The more I thought about it, rather than an offering, maybe it would be our prayer of confession, our admittance that we're out of balance, that we have made ourselves and all our stuff the more valuable than any other species on this planet. And then this got me to thinking as well, what if we were to think of all the practice we've come to recognize as green as a way of praying? Recycling as prayer. Composting as a prayer. Riding your bike as a prayer. Buying used clothes as a prayer. Growing a garden as a prayer. Changing a light bulb as a prayer. Using alternative energy as a prayer. Riding a bus as a prayer. Learning about where our purchases come from as a prayer. Planting a tree as a prayer. Conservation as a prayer. Perhaps we will begin to think of these things not as obligations or as fads or as annoying necessities of the 21st century, but reminders of who we are, dependence on this most amazing planet. In the Celtic tradition, it is said that there are followers of two books, the little book and the big book. The little book, they say, is the scripture. The big book is creation. How does one become a prayer from the earth? We listen to the earth. We stop long enough to hear the wisdom that comes from all the thousands and millions of living beings which we share this planet. Aaron concludes with a poem from Mary Oliver, "The Place I Want to Get Back To," is where in the pine woods, in the moments between the darkness and the first light, two deer came walking down the hill, and when they saw me, they said to each other, "Okay, this one's okay. Let's see who she is and why she is sitting on the ground." Like that, so quiet, as if asleep or in a dream, but anyway, harmless. And so they came on their slender legs and gazed upon me, not unlike the way I go out to the dunes and look and look and look into the faces of the flowers. And then one of them leaned forward and nuzzled my hand. And what can my life bring to me that could exceed that brief moment? For 20 years, I've gone every day to the same woods, not waiting exactly, just lingering. Such gifts bestowed can't be repeated. If you want to come talk about this, come to visit. I live in a house with a corner, which I have named Gratitude. Well, it's 8:30. I just have one more. Do you want to hear it?
Yes.
Okay. It's short also, like Aaron's was. So, but this one by Steve Goodyear, "A Disease We Can Cure," in celebration of Earth Day. Steve Goodyear is from Christ United Methodist Church, also here in Salt Lake City. And it's interesting because Aaron's is a little more cerebral. And George Hanley's, which we heard at the beginning, is much more thought-provoking, more depth, more intellectual and full in its analysis and connection for you as well with it. This one tends to be a little bit more practical, but still thought-provoking at the same time. "God has always spoken through the majesty and wonder of the earth. The world is a sanctuary, and how many times have people experienced the presence of God through its beauty? However, creation is not what it used to be. Half of our forests are gone due to human presence on Earth. Over half of our wetlands are gone. And we can't count the number of species of animals and fish that were extinct due to overhunting, overfishing, urban sprawl. A New Jersey elementary student, a teacher, wrote to me about a field trip that she led to Utah Lake Powell. One night, the students gazed over a spectacular blanket of stars in the sky. Many had never seen anything like that before. One girl thanked her teacher for taking them to Utah. "We don't have stars in New Jersey," she said. In some ways, she's right. I don't believe this is what God had in mind. A world where we can't see the stars, drink the water, or breathe the air. The Bible speaks of God renewing the face of the earth. Humanity is a co-creator, creative mission with God. God's mission is the church's mission. The ancient story of Adam naming the animal suggested that humanity is always participating with God's creation. We are co-creators with God. We create cities to live in. We create metals by combining raw ore. We create new materials and even new molecules. The history of humanity has been more than one of abuse and destruction than the world we live in. And our task today is God's task, to partner with God as God renews the face of the earth. This is a task that is both important and urgent. How can we renew this earth? Learn about the issues. Step number one is to learn about the issues. I was stunned to learn last week that 50% of the Americans do not believe humans contribute to global warming. One school teacher told me that she taught her class about the problems associated with global warming. An irate parent came in the following day and asked, "Do you believe in global warming?" When did science become a matter of belief? Most students and adults don't know the facts concerning environmental issues and don't read about or study the factors relating to our most urgent ecological problems. The first step toward renewing the face of the earth is to learn about the issues. Each of us should begin there. The second thing that Steve mentions is own the problems. Step two is owning the problems. It's easy to say, it's not my problem, it's not my responsibility for polluting the oceans. I didn't cause that brown cloud over Asia. It's not my problem. However, we need to remember that no snowflake ever feels responsible for an avalanche. It is all of them together that contribute to the tumult. And we need not remember that we did not inherit this earth from our ancestors. We borrowed it from our children and their children, and we have a responsibility to them, to generations yet unborn. I like the action of Cynthia Cooper, recently retired from professional basketball as a WNBA player. She made enough money to help her family out, and she decided to support her five nieces and nephews. She didn't shower them with money, but she did move them to a safe neighborhood and gave them good schools to attend. Cynthia could have said, "It's not my problem. They are not my children. I don't have to do anything." But rather, she chose to own the problem. Nothing ever gets fixed until the problem is owned by someone. And the problems associated with ecology must be owned by everyone if they're to be corrected. Work together to solve the problems. Finally, we must work together to solve the problems. We must do what we can to make the situation better. So my family does what it can. We take cloth bags to the grocery store. We buy organic foods. Our home is filled with compact fluorescent lamp bulbs, and we use water-saving faucets. But does it do any good? When I'm the only one in line at the grocery store with a cloth bag, does it really do any good? Does my walking to the store or freezing under the drizzle of my shower make a difference? Can one person affect a change? Our environmental problems are immense. Can one person really do anything significant toward renewing the face of the earth? Let me tell you about flamingos, which are probably like many migrating birds. They flock in huge groups of 1,000 or more. Every year when they come for migration, a few flamingos start the process by taking off from the lake. Since none of the others take any notice, they soon turn around and come back. The next day they try again. This time a few others struggle along. This trend continues for a few days. Each time a few more birds join them, but since the thousands of others take no notice, the migration plan is aborted. Finally, one day, the same few birds take off again, this time together. The tiny increment to their number is enough to tip the balance. As one, the whole flock takes flight and the migration begins. What a spectacular sight it must be, a thousand flamingos or more taking to the sky. True, a few can make a difference. Indeed, any change wrought in the world has come about because of the committed efforts of a few. And it will be the committed few that will change the social conscience and renew the earth. But it's time to take responsibility. Responsibility is the ability to respond. We have to have the ability to respond to our global challenge. Together we can thank God for the gift of the world we live in. It is magnificent beyond words. And then with God, we can work together to renew the face of the earth. Steve likewise closes, and we'll close our session today, with a poem by someone we know, not who the author is. One song can spark a moment. One flower can wake the dream. One tree can start a forest. One bird can herald spring. One smile begins a friendship. One hand clasp lifts a soul. One star can guide a ship at sea. One word can frame the goal. One vote can change a nation. One sunbeam light a room. One candle wipes out darkness. One laugh will conquer gloom. One step must start each journey. One word must start each prayer. One hope will raise our spirits. One touch will show you care. One voice can speak with wisdom. One heart can know what's true. One life can make the difference. You see, it's up to you. Thank you. Good day.